that will further ravage the land. And on the day that the warrant was issued for Kate and Ann, we just got done with a wonderful, magnificent celebration of Juneteenth, remembering these enslaved ancestors.
Pastor Gregory Manning will certainly continue to cover this. A Coalition Against Death Alley and Greater New Orleans Interfaith Climate Coalition and Ann Ralphus, Louisiana Bucket Brigade. That does it for our show. Happy birthday to John Randolph. Please stay safe and wear a mask. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
Are listening to KBOO Portland.
James Chassie, a gentle soul who lived with schizophrenia, was well known in Portland as a writer, artist, and musician. In 2006, James was brutally killed by Portland police. He committed no crime, yet he was tackled, beat, kicked, and tased. He later died in police custody. The police officers who killed James Chassie were never held accountable. Join us on Prison Pipeline, July 6th at 6:30 p.m. as we remember James Chassie.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the ACLU of Oregon files a lawsuit against the Portland Police Bureau, the U.S. Supreme Court strikes down Louisiana abortion restrictions, and the Mississippi legislature votes to remove the Confederate icon from its state flag. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 29th, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon announced Sunday they have filed a class action lawsuit against the City of Portland, the Portland Police Bureau, and other local law enforcement agencies. KBOO's Melissa Hood has more on the story.
The lawsuit, filed by attorneys working with ACLU, claims Portland police have been targeting journalists and legal observers covering recent protests in Portland. The suit claims that police in Portland have tear gassed, pepper sprayed, beaten, and arrested journalists and other neutral bystanders who are documenting the police's behavior during the protests. Kelly Simon, interim legal director of the ACLU of Oregon, said in a statement, quote, "Police in Portland are making a mockery of the First Amendment by targeting journalists, using excessive force, and by using indiscriminate crowd control weapons. Police actions have had a chilling effect on the media and protesters." The lawsuit was filed in the U.S. District Court in Portland and reportedly lists multiple reports of violence against journalists. According to the ACLU, the lawsuit seeks to declare the actions of law enforcement unconstitutional, prohibits them from interfering with journalists in the future, and asks for damages for injuries that occurred during protests. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Melissa Hood.
Protests against racial injustice and police brutality continued on Sunday for the 31st consecutive day. Demonstrators returned to the Justice Center in downtown Portland with a temporary stop at City Hall. Protesters chanted, quote, "Stay together, stay tight, we do this every night." At City Hall, demonstrators removed security cameras and spray-painted Black Lives Matter on the building. At one point during the protest, the driver of a sedan attempted to drive through Southwest 3rd Avenue, where protesters had occupied the road. The driver accelerated through two crowds of demonstrators as people jumped out of the way. It was unclear if anyone was injured in the incident. Over the weekend, demonstrators gathered on Friday at Fields Park for an Abolish ICE protest. Organizers led a march from the park to Terry Schrunk Plaza, across from the U.S. Immigration Courthouse. Protesters heard speakers share their experiences while calling for ICE to be abolished. Friday night's protests ended when police used so-called crowd control munitions to break up demonstrators in the early hours of Saturday morning. The crowd control munitions being used can be seen in cell phone recordings taken by protesters. They include stun grenades and impact munitions. Law enforcement also used tear gas to push back demonstrators. On Saturday, more than 100 people gathered outside the Justice Center downtown. Police declared the protest to be an unlawful assembly around 10:30 p.m. Law enforcement again used crowd control munitions to disperse the demonstrations. Although police say they did not use tear gas this evening, videos on Twitter and other social media sites show CS gas filling the streets on Saturday night. According to the police, 8 people were arrested. Oregon coronavirus cases have climbed recently, just weeks after the state began new reopening efforts. For the third consecutive day, Oregon reported more than 200 new infections on Sunday. Sunday totals included 247 new cases and no deaths, bringing the overall infection count to more than 8,000. In an attempt to slow the spread, Governor Brown says that masks will be required in public spaces in all counties in the state beginning this Wednesday, July 1st. Previously, only some counties were required to wear masks indoors. The Oregon Health Authority released new modeling that predicted exponential growth in the number of infections and said the state could see between 900 and 5,000 cases per day by July 16th. More than 1,400 cases in the past week have been reported. According to the Oregonian, that makes up 17% of all cases in the state. The U.S. Supreme Court invalidated a Louisiana abortion law that significantly limited access to abortion services. The law required abortion clinic doctors to have admitting privileges at a nearby hospital, which is pretty rare, meaning that doctors who perform abortions would be much harder to find. In 2016, the court ruled against a similar law in Texas that sought to require admitting privileges, finding that the law was not medically necessary and that it created barriers to abortion access. Abortion opponents hoped the Supreme Court, with two new conservative appointees, would uphold the law, but Chief Justice John Roberts voted alongside the court's four liberal judges, striking the law down. Chief Justice Roberts' vote came as a surprise for some. In 2016, Roberts voted in favor of that law in Texas. But today, Roberts voted against the Louisiana law on the basis of upholding precedent, arguing that legal doctrine requires the court to treat cases alike. Justice Stephen Breyer, who also voted against the Louisiana law, said the requirements would impose an undue burden and would infringe on the constitutional right to choice. The American Medical Association and other medical groups across the country opposed the requirement. A lower court judge found that complications during an abortion procedure are pretty rare, and that had the law passed, only one clinic and one doctor in the state of Louisiana would be able to perform abortions. This would not be nearly enough to care for the estimated 10,000 women in the state of Louisiana that seek abortions each year, according to NPR. The Supreme Court will not hear a challenge to the federal death penalty method, opening the door for federal executions to resume. The decision means that executions of four federal prison inmates can move forward. Three of the men on death row, Daniel Lee, Wesley Puri, and Dustin Honkin, are scheduled to be executed in July, and the other, Keith Nelson, is scheduled for an execution on August 29th, according to NPR. All four men were convicted for murdering one or more minors. If the men are indeed put to death, they will be the first federal executions since 2003. In 2014, President Obama ordered a review of how executions are carried out after an execution in Oklahoma was drawn out for more than an hour after medical officials had problems inserting an IV. Last summer, Attorney General William Barr said he planned to resume the use of the death penalty with the agent pentobarbital. The attorneys for the inmates argue that using only pentobarbital violates a three-drug execution that many states require. An attorney for one of the inmates also argued that federal executions are racially biased and arbitrary. Barr says that the four men who are scheduled to be executed received fair legal proceedings and that the government owes the victims and their families to carry out their sentences. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with activist Kathy Kelly discussing President Trump's recent visit to Wisconsin to praise a naval contract with Saudi Arabia and the potential impact of that on Yemen. At 6, we'll hear Labor Radio. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline. And then tune in at 7 for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be light rain showers overnight with a low of 59 degrees. Tomorrow will be rainy with a high of 69. Today in history, in 1613, the Globe Theatre in London burned down. The theatre was where most of William Shakespeare's plays debuted. The quote of the day is from Shakespeare's play, All's Well That Ends Well. Shakespeare wrote, quote, "Love all, trust a few, do wrong to none." Black and Latinx young people admitted to jails has fallen faster than the rate for white youth during the COVID-19 pandemic. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Fewer young people are being admitted to jails because of COVID-19. The drop has been bigger for youth of color than their white peers. Annie E. Casey Foundation data from about a third of juvenile detention facilities finds total admissions were down by more than half between March and May. White youth detention fell 26%. Black and Latino youth detention fell 30 and 29%, respectively. Annie Lee, who heads Team Child in Seattle, says people are reevaluating the criminal justice system right now, and this could be an opportunity to reform it.
Let's maintain that level of confidence that community can hold kids safely, that they can be safe, that they don't have to be incarcerated, and restructure how we think about that going forward.
The researchers note this is just a snapshot of juvenile justice systems nationwide. Nate Bayless heads the Casey Foundation's Juvenile Justice Strategy Group. He says it isn't clear what has led to the larger drop in admissions for youth of color, but it could be that fewer young people are being arrested for minor offenses.
There are young people who may have been admitted to secure detention centers 3 months ago who simply aren't being admitted anymore.
There are other pushes to close the racial gap in juvenile justice. The Casey Foundation has been working with what are known as Juvenile Detention Alternatives Initiative sites, including one in Pierce County. These reform efforts are at the so-called deep end facilities, where kids are sent after sentencing, like youth prisons and group homes. And it's the phase of juvenile justice where racial disparities are highest. Bayless says there should be more opportunities for them to stay in their communities.
It's about changing probation practices, making sure that there are services that support young people at home and support their families. It's about keeping most young people out of the juvenile justice system altogether by diverting them.
For Public News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
The Confederate flag's place on the Mississippi state flag will soon be a thing of the past. Mississippi lawmakers passed historic legislation to remove the Confederate emblem from the state flag. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves, who's a Republican, plans to sign the bill after reviewing it. The bill received broad support in the Mississippi House, which passed it 91-23. The measure passed the Senate with a wide majority as well, with a vote of 37-14. The Confederate flag has long been a symbol associated with racism and white supremacy because it was used by the South during the American Civil War, which was fought by the Confederacy to preserve slavery. Mississippi first included the Confederate battle emblem on its flag in 1894. The bill also includes plans for the development of a new design for the Mississippi flag that does not include Confederate iconography. The decision is in line with national efforts to purge racist symbols and figures from public places as protests against systemic racism and police brutality continue around the country. House Majority Whip James Clyburn, the chair of the committee overseeing the federal response to COVID-19, has announced he will no longer recognize members of the committee who do not use a facial covering. This announcement follows a Friday hearing in which Representatives Steve Scalise, Jim Jordan, and Mark Green, all Republican, reportedly refused to wear face masks. In a letter sent to Scalise, the committee's ranking member, Clyburn pointed out an existing new requirement for lawmakers to wear masks while participating in House meetings. Clyburn wrote in the letter, quote, "Going forward, as long as the attending physician's requirement to wear masks is in place, I will not recognize any member of the subcommittee to participate in person in any subcommittee or hearing unless the member is wearing a mask and strictly adheres to the attending physician's guidance." The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends all Americans wear face masks when in public settings. Clyburn said that committee members who do not want to wear face masks can participate remotely, and says he believes Congress is liable to protect, quote, "our colleagues, our staffs, our witnesses, the Capitol Police and custodial, and other frontline workers from potentially deadly exposure to coronavirus." While Black Lives Matter protests are continuing today, 51 years ago, the Stonewall riots occurred in New York City. Vice President Mike Pence went to Texas but canceled events in Arizona and Florida because of COVID-19 concerns, and an FEC commissioner resigned, making the agency unable to enforce campaign finance laws. With more on those stories, we go to Lily Bolke with 2020 Talks.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 elections in uncharted territory.
We must remember that Pride was started as a riot in New York City, where I am from, with trans women of color at the forefront.
That riot was 51 years ago yesterday when officers raided the Stonewall Inn, a gay bar in New York City, following years of police harassment and discrimination. It's Pride Month, a time to celebrate the LGBTQ community. Nalini Stamp with the Working Families Party says we must recognize the methods of the past when looking at Black Lives Matter today.
The power of protest and uprisings is something that we stand on the shoulders of giants of. The only way that we have gotten the victories that we have gotten is through uprisings and mass popular support.
Former Vice President Joe Biden has supported peaceful protests, but many activists feel his policing plan isn't enough. President Donald Trump yesterday retweeted a video where apparent supporters say, quote, "white power" to Black Lives Matter demonstrators. He deleted it after the Senate's only Black Republican, Tim Scott, criticized the tweet on CNN. Vice President Mike Pence visited Dallas, Texas yesterday, but canceled upcoming events in Arizona and Florida, the three are battleground states and also rising COVID-19 hotspots. Here's Texas State Representative Retta Bowers.
We are the biggest battleground state, and that's why they keep coming back.
Black, Indigenous, and people of color have been hit the hardest by COVID-19. In many industries, essential workers are proportionately more people of color, increasing their exposure, and research shows systemic racism contributes to underlying health conditions.
These issues are not new to communities of color, African-American communities and Latinos, and so we just have to say that people are suffering, and we will continue to suffer until those most vulnerable, the needs are addressed.
Late last week, the U.S. Supreme Court opted not to force Texas to expand absentee voting, but Dallas County Judge Clay Jenkins appealed to Governor Greg Abbott to do it anyway. Today's the first day of early voting for the state's runoff elections.
Please reconsider your decision not to let people under 65 vote by mail. At a time when we are seeing a second wave, frankly, because of the way that you opened Texas and didn't have requirements,
the Federal Election Commission, charged with preventing campaign finance violations, is once again unable to take action. After almost a year with no oversight due to a lack of quorum of commissioners, Texas Attorney Trey Traynor's appointment brought the agency to speed for less than a month before Republican Commissioner Caroline Hunter resigned. Rutgers Law professor Eugene Mazo explains why lack of quorum is such a problem.
If my opponent is violating the law and somehow I can complain to the FEC, and the FEC can bring an enforcement action. But that can only happen if there is a quorum of four commissioners.
Trump quickly nominated Alan Dickerson, the legal director of the pro-Citizens United Free Speech Institute, and Mississippi lawmakers voted yesterday to remove the Confederate emblem, the last in the country to use it, from their state flag. From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
A coalition of Indigenous women is calling on former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper to drop out of the U.S. Senate race over what they say are disparaging images. With that story and more, it's Megan Kamrick with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Megan Kamrick in for Antonia Gonzalez. Indigenous activists are asking former Colorado Governor John Hickenlooper to drop out of the Democratic Senate primary over photos of him in what they say is imitative Native American clothing. Common Dreams reports a coalition of Indigenous women and their allies sent an open letter on Saturday outlining Hickenlooper's participation in a hunting competition where they say winners are dressed in war bonnets and losers must dress like quote-unquote squaws. The letter points out this ethnic slur is associated with sexual assault of Native North American Indian women. The one-shot antelope hunt has been a tradition in Wyoming for many decades. A 2012 video from Wyoming PBS shows the clothing being placed on the winners and losers by members of the Shoshone tribe. Other groups joined the letter, including Sunrise Movement, Converge Colorado, and the Indigenous Environmental Network. The latest controversy follows others, including a video that has surfaced showing Hickenlooper 6 years ago comparing a politician's schedule to working on a slave ship. The letter says he has shown a pattern of, quote, harmful behavior. The Ho-Chunk Nation in Wisconsin has permanently laid off an undetermined number of tribal employees. The tribe has several casinos in Wisconsin that have been affected by coronavirus closures and restrictions. In a video statement, Ho-Chunk President Myron White Eagle said the difficult decision is aimed at preserving the nation's financial health.
This is a hard road to recovery to where we were pre-pandemic. No one knows when we'll get back to those conditions. We hope to recall as many as employees as we can. But the future is uncertain.
White Eagle said laid-off employees are not eligible for health insurance through the tribe, but they can seek services with the state. He said tribal officials failed to approve a budget for the coming fiscal year, but instead are working with a bare-bones 60-day operating budget in the hopes of the financial picture improves. Navajo Nation leaders want New Mexico to end efforts to dismiss a landmark education case meant to address educational inequities in the state. President Jonathan Nez and Vice President Myron Leiser sent a letter to lawmakers expressing their opposition to a motion to dismiss the Yazzie Martinez lawsuit. Nez says Native students deserve an educational environment that prioritizes their culture and unique needs. A judge ruled in 2018 that New Mexico had denied English language learners, special education, Native American, and low-income students their constitutional right to a sufficient education. The Santa Fe New Mexican reports the state filed a motion in March to dismiss the suit because it claims it has met the requirements of the decision. The New Mexico Center on Law and Poverty, which is representing the Yazzie plaintiffs, argues the state's efforts have been piecemeal. In an op-ed in the Albuquerque Journal, they write there are still large inequities in access to reliable internet and technology, and they say there's still a lack of culturally and linguistically appropriate instructional materials, and there's a shortage of certified teachers. In Brazil, people mourned the death of Kayapo leader and rainforest defender Paulino Paiacan from COVID-19. Public Radio International reported Paiacan played a key role in the creation of tribal territory and ensuring indigenous rights were included in the country's constitution. The New York Times reports Paiacan traveled the world mourning of the destruction of the Amazon, appearing with celebrities like Sting. But in the early 1990s, he was accused of rape. Supporters claimed the charges were created to silence him. More than 300 indigenous people in the Amazon have died from COVID-19. The Guardian reports fears are rising the virus will bring terrible losses of knowledge in tribal history, culture, and traditional medicine. Many indigenous leaders accuse the government of far-right President Jair Bolsonaro of failing to protect Brazil's indigenous people by delaying aid and forcing them to risk infection by traveling to nearby towns for help. For National Native News, I'm Megan Kamrick.
Like prisons and jails, immigration detention centers are potential hotspots for the spread of COVID-19. Andrea Sears has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Immigrants held in crowded ICE detention centers are extremely vulnerable to the spread of infectious diseases, including COVID-19, and the risks can be especially high for lesbian, gay, bisexual, or transgender people. The Free Them All campaign is a joint effort of immigrants' rights groups across the country. It's called for the release of everyone in immigration detention to reduce the risk of the deadly virus spreading among the detainees. Jan Zadanovich with the Queer Detainee Empowerment Project says discrimination and harassment faced by those who are LGBT magnifies those risks.
They go through sexual violence on a daily basis. Trans women are held in solitary confinement for weeks, sometimes months, sometimes years.
QDEP works to find pro bono lawyers for LGBT detainees and finds them sponsors to help expedite their release on parole or bond. Zdanovich notes that detainees living with HIV are in the high-risk category for infection and death from COVID, and detention centers have a poor track record for providing medical care.
We hear too many stories about them not having access to their medication, sometimes for months, and very often people are not provided HIV tests inside of detention.
The Free Them All campaign is working with lawyers to secure the release of detainees living with HIV as soon as possible. Those efforts are getting results. Zdanovich says before the COVID pandemic, they had 160 members in immigration detention. That number has been reduced to 60. And he adds they continue to get assistance once they're released.
We provide post-release support to folks who are eligible for free housing in New York City. We also connect people with medical care. We have mental health and healing support program.
He says releasing immigrants from detention also frees up taxpayer dollars for the fight against a public health crisis that continues to grow in many parts of the country. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
Researchers estimate that around 18.9 billion pounds of glyphosate, the key ingredient in the weed killer Roundup, has been used globally. The recent $10 billion settlement highlights the EPA's regulatory failures. Nadia Ramlagan has more on this story with the Public News Service.
The German company Bayer has agreed to shell out $10 billion to around 95,000 plaintiffs who alleged that glyphosate, the key ingredient in its Roundup weed killer, gave them cancer. Roundup originally was developed by Monsanto in the early 1970s. Bayer bought the company in 2018 and says the agreements contain no admission of liability or wrongdoing. Senior scientist at the Center for Biological Diversity, Nathan Donnelly, says the health concerns around glyphosate are alarming, yet the herbicide continues to be touted as safe by Bayer and the EPA.
We use around 300 million pounds of it each year in the United States, and that's just in the agricultural sector. That's not counting what people use in their homes. Many people have seen it when they walk into their local hardware store or big box store. It's generally right there up front.
According to the State Department of Health and Human Services, North Carolina is home to more than 48,000 farms and ranks 13th nationwide for use of pesticides and herbicides, such as Roundup, in agriculture. The state's farms also employ large numbers of migrant workers to apply pesticides to fields. Donnelly says the settlement does nothing to rein in Roundup's use.
It doesn't attempt to put a warning label, for instance, on bottles of Roundup saying that it could potentially cause cancer.
Wrapped up in the settlement, he says, is hundreds of millions of dollars going toward farmers who have been harmed by another herbicide produced by Bayer called dicamba, as well as for water contamination caused by PCB pollution.
You know, this is really indicative of an absolute regulatory collapse in the U.S. when it comes to dangerous pollutants like these, and it should really be a wake-up call to the EPA.
In 2015, the International Agency for Research on Cancer stated that glyphosate probably is carcinogenic to humans. For Public News Service, I'm Nadia Ramlagan.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Monday, June 29th, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Melissa Hood, Heather McCoy, and Piper McDaniel, as well as Jinka Soderberg. The producer is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Lily Bolke, Megan Kamrick, and Eric Tegadoff. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 8, it's the Abe and Joe Talk Radio Show, covering politics, history, and the state of the zeitgeist. At 9, we'll hear alternative radio, featuring lectures and interviews with progressive thinkers. At 10, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we'll hear Stage and Studio. Host Ime Roberts highlights Portland actor and political and media consultant Shanee Harris Bagwell. At 11:30, it's Art Focus, featuring interviews with artists, curators, and critics talking about art, how it's made, and what it means. All of these wonderful KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our listeners. If you'd like to support our programming, go to kboo.fm or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
We are joined today by Kathy Kelly. She is a longtime peace activist with Voices for Creative Nonviolence. Let's first just talk about the situation in Yemen. I know that they have been impacted by COVID-19, and especially since Yemen has already had one of the worst humanitarian situations in the world due to the ongoing Saudi bombing.
Well, yeah, it's the Saudi bombing and also significantly the blockade, because and using these littoral combat ships, which are able to go up along the sides of coastlines. The Saudis have blocked all of the coastal ports. They've blocked the major airport, so that the area where 70% of the people live, which is the area controlled by the Houthis, has been under a blockade now for close to 4 years. And this has been certainly exacerbating the conflict in terrible, terrible ways. People aren't able to get fuel. They're not able to get food. Food prices then go up. People have been unable to get anything close to what would be needed for healthcare. So over half of the hospitals and healthcare facilities have closed down. And right now, UNICEF issued probably the most worrisome recent report. They said that millions of children will be pushed to the brink of starvation if massive amounts of funding aren't made available. And at this time, when, as you mentioned, you know, COVID-19 is likely to ravage the lives of people in villages and communities, cities where they don't have health care. But President Trump and the U.S. administration decided to do is cut back on funding from USAID. And then the World Food Program had to cut back because they were running out of funds. And what this does is make people in Yemen almost like hostages to wealthy groups like the Saudis, who can say, you need money, we'll host a fundraising event for you, you know, and we can raise loads and loads of money, but you'll have to accept our will or bow to us in order to get that money. And so it's almost like holding people hostage in this very, very desperate situation.
In the midst of this, this past Thursday, Donald Trump went to Wisconsin and went to the Marinette shipyard in Marinette, Wisconsin, to praise the contract for making these littoral naval ships for the Saudi Navy. Can you talk a little bit about that visit and those ships, and what does that mean?
Well, the littoral combat ship is something that the United States Navy had been purchasing from the shipyard in Marinette and from other places. But then the U.S. Navy decided, you know what, we really don't want that ship any longer. And it was setting its sights on a new frigate. They hadn't bought any new major destroyer ships for 10 years, but now they had a desire to start building up the United States Navy fleet to reach at least 355 ships so that the United States could threaten certainly China and Russia primarily in the seas. Well, so that ship hadn't been commissioned yet, this model for a new kind of ship, and the shipyard in Marinette was possibly going to go without any jobs and would even possibly have to shut down when Lockheed Martin made a proposal to the United States Navy to create four of these littoral combat ships, not for sale to the U.S. Navy at the end of the line, but rather for the U.S. Navy to then sell them to Saudi Arabia. Why does Saudi Arabia want weaponized ships that they can use that will go right along the coastline? It's the kind of ship they've already been using to blockade Yemen. And so, you know, when legislators in Wisconsin say, oh, please, please give us the contract for the next generation of these warships, that's meaningful work for people in our state. It's valuable work for people. What is so meaningful and valuable about creating these lethal ships to sell to despots in the Middle East or to further provoke the possibility of a hot war with Russia and China for the future ships that are going to be made? So I really admired Lisa Savage in Maine. I asked her, well, what do you think? You know, Bath Iron Works in Maine really wanted that contract for the Navy ships that the U.S. Navy will build, these new, they call them multi-mission surface ships that can simultaneously attack ships at sea and places on the land and submarines. Like, this is this great new ship that's cheaper and faster than the ships they had before. And Lisa Savage just said quite simply that it's not success, it's not a win to gain these kinds of contracts, that the United States groups that are manufacturing weapons of war are holding the United States back and holding us to a time that's where it's just not viable for industries all across the United States to be dependent on war and weapon making. And particularly in a time of pandemic, we're seeing the need for interconnectivity and the folly and the futility of continuing to wage these wars.
And I noticed that this contract to make these ships will add 1,000 jobs to the facility in Marinette, Wisconsin. But what would be the difference if they decided to manufacture something else in these shipbuilding facilities, like, alternative energy, clean energy systems?
Well, again, Lisa Savage has done quite a lot of research on the possibilities of more jobs being generated if shipyards, for instance, were to be creating things that were good for people, that were contributing towards sustainability. And even Bath Iron Works in Maine, since the time of the pandemic beginning, has figured out a way to manufacture some materials that can be used for protective equipment. I mean, certainly the idea that Lockheed Martin, with all of its billions and billions of dollars, could say, we're going to be very serious now about investigating ways to develop high-speed transit facilities, about investigating ways to examine the housing stock in the United States and figure out how to retrofit it so that it's going to be reliant on sustainable energy, or harvesting wind energy, or making different kinds of ships that could be used for civilian purposes in the United States for transportation. There are all kinds of ways that scientists could devote themselves to helping us cope with the greatest threats we face, which are certainly climate catastrophe and now living in a time of pandemic and the potential for nuclear war. But our situation is so beholden right now with elected representatives constantly saying, we can't keep ourselves in our positions, we can't keep our industries going if we don't beg the military-industrial complex to pick us, choose us, give us your contracts, because that's what the United States manufactures these days.
You know, it used to be maybe that people made weapons so they could fight wars, but now we're in the business of looking for wars or waging wars so that we can make weapons. So it's especially terrible with regard to the ships that the Fincantieri Marinette shipyard right now are making for the Saudis, because it sends a green light to Saudi Arabia. It says to the Saudis, you know, when push comes to shove, the United States will continue sending armaments, will continue kind of giving a thumbs up. And then, of course, for this next contract that they've now gotten to build this, like a destroyer ship, but they call it a frigate. If they're successful, then there's the option to build 10 more ships. So, yes, that will bring jobs and funds and additional support economy into the shipyard in Marinette. But I think what we ought to all be looking at is this presumption that these are valuable and meaningful and good jobs for people to have.
And is there anything that people can do if they feel compelled to take action on this issue? Is there someone they can call? Is there a website they can go to get involved?
Well, I've been very appreciative of the Twitter account of a professor from the University of Southern Michigan. Her name is Shireen Al-Adeni, and people could Google her or go to something that I've written about Yemen in the past and find Shireen, Dr. Shireen Al-Adeni. And along with her, she's from Yemen and studied at Harvard and now is a professor in Michigan. Along with her, there's a woman named Aisha Juman who lives in Seattle, and she has a website for coordination of distributing food and medicines, and she's been doing it in as a grassroots organization, and she's an epidemiologist and travels to Yemen at least once or twice a year to help coordinate this food distribution. And again, if her name is Juman, Aisha Juman. I greatly respect the work that she's doing. I also think that it's important to stay in touch with what the Friends Commission on National Legislation is writing through Hassan Al-Qayyab. So that's FCNL.org. And if anybody wanted to be in touch with us at Voices, we do hope to do a walk from Green Bay, Wisconsin to the Marinette shipyard. We're not sure with the pandemic conditions when that might happen. I also sometimes think, you know, it's an appropriate time to certainly go to General Dynamics or Raytheon or Boeing or Lockheed, all these companies that are making enormous profits from selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. And perhaps it's a time to begin fasting, long-term vigils in New York. If anyone is ever heading to New York or has relatives in New York, every Saturday at 11 o'clock, people gather from various groups in New York, organized by the New York Catholic Worker, to have a vigil regarding Yemen. The same is happening in Boston, Massachusetts. Massachusetts Peace Action and the Raytheon campaign have focused on Yemen. Another thing people can do is organize webinars and ask people to speak, people like Shireen Al-Adeni or Aisha Juman or Hassan Al-Tayyab, all very available and very eloquent speakers with regard to the issues affecting Yemen.
Well, thanks very much for those resources. We'll also post them on the KBOO website, kboo.fm, and Aisha Juman's website is yemenfoundation.org. Thank you, Kathy Kelly, for joining us today on KBOO and sharing this important information about the situation in Yemen and the current plan for the contract, the Marinette shipyard in Wisconsin, to build frigate naval ships for the Saudi Navy that will then be used, I'm sure, to attack the civilians in Yemen. Thank you for joining us, Kathy.
All right. Thank you, Jenka.
This is Jenka Soderberg reporting for KBOO News.
Welcome to the KBOO Evening News. I'm Heather McCoy. Last Friday, June 26th, there was a large protest downtown led by a group called the People vs. ICE PDX. The march was peaceful and called to attention the horrific conditions ICE detainees face both in the informal concentration camps and the prison facilities where ICE contracts out space. Andrea Sid is joining us to discuss the current conditions for ICE detainees and the fight to abolish ICE. Welcome to the Evening News.
Thanks for having me. Really appreciate that.
Oh, you're very welcome. At the rally at Terry Struck Plaza, there's a number of speakers making the connection between the fight against police fatality and how U.S. Immigrations and Customs Enforcement, ICE, operates. Can you make some of those connections for our listeners?
Yeah, I think the overall link that we are trying to connect is that this fight to abolish ICE is the same as the fight to, you know, defund police or abolish the police. It's the same objective. It is also a Black Lives Matter issue. We give thanks to the Black Lives Matter movement specifically, just because the turnout would not have been as big if it was not for what they're doing. So we thank them enormously. We give them a big thanks for opening the pathway for us to be able to do this and have recognition. Our biggest thing is that it is not just the Latinx community that is being affected by ICE. There are also Black immigrants, people who are undocumented, who are being abused. And our biggest concern when it comes to the abuse is from ICE is mostly the children. That is our biggest concern, is making sure that the children are safe, sound, and reunited with their families.
Yeah, on June 26th, the same day as the rally, announced at the rally as everyone was starting to leave, a federal judge ordered that all children in ICE custody for more than 20 days, they are to be released July 17th. What is the impact of this ruling?
Yeah, that was very emotional. We literally found out minutes after the event officially concluded. So I got back on the mic and I made everyone freeze. And as soon as I announced that was just an overwhelming amount of emotion from everyone, from myself as well. I tried to hold back tears just because it was just so overwhelming, and we're very happy and pleased to be hearing such a thing. You know, this is obviously a very small step, and so we hope to just keep continuing to spread awareness of what's going on, because change can happen the more aware people are.
In 2018 and 2019, the fact that our government was running a collection of what are concentration camps is front page news. Since the COVID-19 pandemic has swept the world, how badly has already horrible conditions gotten? Also, according to ICE's website, the agency has stopped in-person visits due to COVID. How are the detainees getting access to the outside world to connect with their families and contribute to our understanding of what's happening within the confines of the walls?
That's one of our biggest concerns as well, is because that's not being made very clear. I know a few years back, Senator Jeff Merkley had tried to visit one of these detention centers that I believe was just an abandoned Walmart.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have some pushback to try to find out these answers, but as for now, this is all just reports. We can't officially confirm everything, which is scary for a lot of people. Why is this not public knowledge? Why are people not aware? Why is ICE not being open about this? What are they hiding? So that's a big concern that we share as well, and that we're trying to work on as well, because we don't have any concrete answers.
COVID, how is that has spread throughout detention centers? I know that the New York Times, I believe, on June 18th published something where the five biggest outbreaks were all within prisons. ICE has known the contract out for square footage in prisons. The country of Guatemala is not taking basically expelled people from the U.S. because it contributed to 15% of their confirmed cases of COVID. What are the conditions like for the spread of the disease within the prison walls?
For ICE facilities, or
just ICE facilities specific? Is it worse than just regular prison, or is it kind of on par with that, or is it too hard to tell?
It is a bit too hard to tell. We know that ICE is trying to take measures to help prevent the spread of COVID. But the biggest issue we have is how they're going about that. They're starting to spray people reportedly up to 100 times a day with HDQ neutral, which is a sanitizing spray that is meant to disinfect surfaces. It's not meant to be near people. You know, it says keep out of reach of children, wear goggles, gloves when handling, wash hands, anything that is exposed. So, you know, we really can't say, because we know that any mistreatment or any symptoms that people are having, it's mainly a result of HDQ neutral, because it causes, you know, problems with lungs, it causes bleeding, it causes permanent skin and eye damage. So we can't really say where all of these symptoms are coming from specifically, because HDQ neutral is also making people sick as well.
Yeah, and I think that was a detention center run by the GEO Group. Yeah, and so do you know if that spray is more than just that one prison in California? Is it in a lot of places?
We're not sure with that either. Again, we're hearing different reports, which again is one of our biggest issues, is why are we not getting concrete answers? And if there are concrete answers, why is this not being known? Like, this is important information that the public needs to know. This needs to be handed to us. So again, that's also one of our biggest concerns.
Portland has a history of protest movements around the evolution of ICE. There is Occupy ICE in, I think, 16 or 17. City governments tend to be more responsive to protest movements, as some cities are defunding the police in the wake of the George Floyd protests. How do you create a nationwide movement around the abolishment of ICE?
You know, that's one of our, you know, another thing we're looking into as well. We're trying to take, we're definitely inspired by the Black Lives Matter movement that's taking place here in Portland. So a lot of what we're doing is trying to see what works, what doesn't, and experiment, really, because we are so new. This is only our second event that we have planned, so we are just mainly drawing inspiration from the Black Lives Matter movement, and, you know, getting in contact with other organizations who have been doing this, what results, you know, we can achieve with, you know, depending on what we do. We want to know what works best. So we're really just looking into what other groups have been doing, especially the Black Lives Matter movement.
How can listeners connect with your movement to find out when next actions are taking place and how they can get involved?
How people can get involved with our next event?
Yeah.
Where
do they connect to get involved with your group and then upcoming events?
Right. So we are having a next event July 11th. We're not sure on all the details, but yeah, definitely the People versus ICE PDX. We are on Instagram with that username, Twitter with that username, as well as Facebook with that username. And then our Gmail for a lot of people who do want to volunteer and offer services, we ask that you email us, because it's just easier to organize that way, at thepeopleversusicepdx@gmail.com.
My guest has been Andrea Sid with the People versus ICE PDX. Thanks for being on the KBOO News.
No, thank you so much for having me. We're so grateful. Thank you.
Friday, June 26th, educators and students came together in support of Black Lives Matter. On Stark Street, East County educators lined up to show their solidarity with the Black Lives Matter movement. KBOO's Janka Soderberg was there to hear from educators about their reasons for protesting.
I'm here, I teach in Penrose, and I see the effect. effects of systemic racism on a daily basis, and I don't want that for my students anymore.
How do you see the effects of systemic racism on your students?
I know that many of them are dealing with generational trauma that stems from racist institutions. And I know looking, you know, at not just our schools, but all schools, our data when it comes to student achievement and our data when it comes to student discipline is disproportionate. And that's falling on the shoulders of our students of color. And so I want to make sure that changes. Not only in education, but in sort of all aspects of society.
And when you hear about the school-to-prison pipeline, how do you see that play out in the school system?
I think that the disciplinary studies have shown that our kids of color are behaving in many of the same ways as our white kids, but they're getting disproportionately disciplined. And so that's gone. I want my classroom community to be a safe place for every single child. And I can't promise them right now that that's happening, you know. So I want to do the work within myself, but also do the work within society and make sure that I'm putting pressure on the people with the power to make real change.
So what are you demanding?
So I am demanding change from the highest level all the way down to, what we're doing in our classrooms and what admin is doing. So I think if we don't keep the pressure on, then nothing will happen. So we just have to keep the pressure on. We have to keep writing our legislators. We have to get people registered to vote. We got to just keep the pressure going. Otherwise, we're just going to end up in the same place again and again and again.
Do you want to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Erin Wagner. I'm an eighth grade teacher in Park Rose.
Thank you.
Thank you.
You want to talk to KBOO Community Radio? Just ask him why people are out and what this is about.
I'm a public school teacher, and it's pretty evident that racism is baked into all of the institutions in this country, including our public schools. And I think it's incredibly important for individual teachers to take on the fight against racism in our own classrooms, but also fight for systematic change, system-wide change. And I think that connecting the fight for Black lives to the fight for equity in our schools is incredibly important. We exist in the same world that the rest of this is going on, and our schools are not separate, and teachers need to be part of the fight for a better world and a fight to end racism.
And I heard a young woman at Peninsula Park talk about her school, her classroom where she was teaching, and that some of the kids, really young kids, would engage in racism and that they were learning it at home. How do you intervene as an educator in those types of situations?
Oh, that is a really good question, because it does come up periodically. I think the number one priority is to protect the students of color and interrupt the racism. You don't protect the white kids' feelings in the moment. Stopping it in the moment is the most important thing, and then what comes after is also incredibly important. Use it as a teachable moment to talk to the student that was harmed, the student that did the harm, and the rest of the class to make sure that students that are harmed have an opportunity to get some sort of restoration. A lot of times we use the phrase restorative justice, and the aim of that is not punishment. The aim is for when someone is harmed, for the person that harms them to try and actually fix things. And I think that that's the approach that I would take in my classroom, is to hold myself and my students accountable and use it as a teachable moment to explain why whatever transpired was not okay.
How do you think we can redistribute funding from the police to things that make sense, like what's on your sign, education, healthcare?
I think defunding the police is actually much more simple than people think it is. I would love to have different resources in my community other than just call the police for everything. Like, literally take money from the police budget, put it towards social services, and we will have more options to keep our community safer.
You want to say something for KBOO?
I'll just say I also feel, besides, I'm a teacher also. Uh-huh. And I feel the same way, but I also feel as a mother, I feel like I want to express my sorrow and my protest at how the discrimination and racism that's in our culture. And as a mother and a teacher, I feel like I need to do something about it. This is one way.
Thank you. Do you want to say anything for KBOO?
Well, along the lines of, in terms of looking at public safety and evaluating when the police or when the current fire department goes out to respond, what are they responding to? And if 50% of your responses are to mental health or homeless issues, then you should have people who are trained to deal with mental health and homeless issues rather than saying that is police that go to do that. And so, like she was saying, in terms of, it's not saying there will not be police, it's that you're putting the resources where they need to be. And also with firefighters, the majority of calls go out on physical health, EMTs. And so change the paradigm and meet the needs that we have, put the money where it's supposed to be with appropriate training and appropriate staff so that everybody can be safe and everybody can have their basic needs met and have housing and food and all of that, looking at where there's housing insecurity and food insecurity and respond to those issues.
Do you, as an educator, come across students that are lacking in those kinds of basic needs, like housing and just the basic needs of life?
Definitely, and especially when we went to the spring with teaching distance learning. And in this area, we have many families that do not have internet access. And so it's saying, well, they could go get a hotspot. Well, that means that somebody in the family has to take them to a hotspot. They have to be able to be there at the hotspot. Our district was working to get devices to families, but it would be one device for five kids. And so if you look at other communities where internet isn't that much of a challenge and having devices isn't a challenge. I had a student who was trying to do his work on his mother's phone. He can't do it. And I really worry about in the fall if we haven't figured out how